I love watching the fireworks on New Year's Eve. I don't know if anyone else does, though I don't love it enough to camp out all day in the city, fighting my way through the crowds. But that's okay, because scattered throughout the country are places you can go and watch local celebrations. I was at the entrance this year on the Central Coast. There's normally a carnival of some sort, merry-go-rounds for the kids, Ferris wheels, face painting, music. And then as it grows darker, people bring out glow sticks or sparklers. There we all sit or stand, gazing upwards as light bursts above us in an array of colours. And for a moment, it seems like we are all united, together, and everything is going to be okay. It's going to be a good year. Now, maybe there's a little bit of superstition here. The Chinese, the first to use fireworks, set them off in part to chase off evil spirits and bring in good luck. We say it's going to be a good year, and I'm going to make the changes that need to be made so it will be a good year. But maybe there's a part of us that is bluffing, that's not so sure. What does 2024 hold for us? I want to begin the year by reflecting on Jesus' life as told in the Gospel of John. John's Gospel is clear that there will be troubles and hardships. But beyond this, this is a gospel that bursts with joy, believes there is good, that change is coming for the better. After John's poetic opening, which we looked at Christmas, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God and is God, the light of the world bursting in the darkness. John the Baptist identifies this light as Jesus. We then come down to the ordinary, days passing. Jesus, now an adult, calls people to be his disciples, learn how to live from him. And then comes a celebration. John 2, verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Celebrations are crucial. We need them throughout the year to mark significant milestones, times when we can let our hair down and relax, laugh, connect with others. Celebrations can take us out of our normal routines, help us take stock of our lives. I love the beginning of the year for this reason. It is full of celebrations. Christmas, New Year's Eve, my birthday, all the important events. Although at Christmas, when I was catching up with my extended family, my great aunt sighed and said, "Oh, it's been a while since we've had a wedding in this family. That's what we need. We've had a few funerals, but wouldn't it be nice to have a big wedding?" Weddings often feel like one of the biggest celebrations we can have. People love them because ideally they burst with joy. Like my great aunt, the people of Galilee also love a big wedding. It is common to keep on celebrating for up to a week. The relatives come in, crowding up the homes in town. Friends come, there are kids running around, music playing. It grows darker, and under the stars come out trays of food and cups full of wine. And for a moment, everyone seems united, together. Everything is going to be okay. This couple is in love and embarking on a life together, committing themselves to each other. It's good. It's worth pausing here for a moment and recognizing that Jesus is here, and by extension, God. God loves to celebrate just as much as we do. This sounds obvious, but Christians can have a reputation for being party poopers, don't you think? Always serious, no fun allowed, because God is serious and doesn't enjoy parties. Rebecca Snownett sees Christianity as pushing joy far away, off to the afterlife, unconcerned with what brings happiness or comfort in the here and now. That has definitely been the perspective of some Christians. But it's not just Christians. Snownett says many activists and revolutionaries have this mentality as well. They focus on the practical issues at hand that need changing, like employment conditions or basic needs being met or policy changes, and sometimes dismiss things that bring joy, like music or art or holidays, as frivolous, a distraction from the important changes that need to happen. Rebecca tells the story of Helen Todd, a suffragist campaigner going around the states in the 1910s wanting conditions to be better for women. One night, as she stays with a family on a farm, the hired girl comments that what stood out for her at the meeting calling for equal rights was the idea that everybody would have both bread and flowers. She loved this image. Helen was so moved that this actually became the slogan going forward: bread and roses. Poems and songs were later created calling for this. Bread standing for the basic necessities we need in life, and flowers for all the things that bring people joy. This is a quote from Solnit. It was equally an argument against the idea that everything that human beings need can be reduced to quantifiable, tangible goods and conditions. Roses in these declarations stood for the way that human beings are complex, desires are irreducible, that what sustains us is often subtle and elusive. Bread and roses. The wedding in John 2 is not necessary in the strictest sense. It's an over-the-top celebration bursting with unexpected joy. And yet Jesus is right in the middle of it. This wedding reminds us of all the other images and stories throughout Scripture where we see God celebrating. God even sometimes describes himself as a groom pledging his love and commitment to his people. We see God preparing a feast for us with the richest foods and the finest wines, people dancing up and down the streets, singing and laughing. As we begin this new year, one of the things I want us to consider is this last sentence in our vision statement. We see a church scattering the gospel in word and action all over the place. I want to help you to keep seeing that the good news of God can be found all over the place. God cares for flowers as well as bread. When we watch the fireworks burst or enjoy a concert or bring out a cake and sing, dance at a wedding reception, go to the beach, God is with us. We say, what a good wedding. Everyone is happy, all the hard work is done, God is here. But maybe there's a part of us that is bluffing, that's not so sure. Even though in this culture, it's the groom's responsibility to organize the wedding celebrations, Mary, the mother of Jesus, seems to be struggling to relax and celebrate. She is worried, finding it hard to trust in joy, take in the good. She's walking around the place looking for what disaster could be about to strike, and she finds it. The wine has run out. This would bring great shame to the family and spoil the party, so she goes straight to Jesus with this news and dumps her stress on him. Now, this is a little strange. Like, why Jesus? Is he somehow responsible for this wedding? Does she expect him to do something incredible? Is Jesus just a resourceful guy, good in a crisis? Is he the first person she sees? Whatever her reasons, Jesus doesn't sound particularly interested in helping. John 2 verse 4, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." Celebrations aren't just joyous occasions. They can take a lot of work and can be incredibly stressful. There are always people behind the scenes running around, working out logistics, catering and hosting so everything comes together smoothly. For some reason, Jesus' mother seems to be taking on a lot of this responsibility. I actually have a friend, Rachel, who decided to start her own business, Bubbles and Bouquets, and become a wedding planner after getting married herself. She found the experience so stressful, and she could see how overwhelmed her family and close friends were as they tried to support her and make everything run smoothly on the day, that she decided to become the person who could help other couples, the person who knows what's happening, in charge of logistics, solving any problem or crisis that might occur. Unfortunately, there's no wedding planner in Cana. Instead, Mary turns to Jesus and he rebuffs her. Indeed, Jesus sounds a little rude. He brushes her off and says, "This is not my problem." Maybe he just wants to unwind and celebrate. But then he adds cryptically, "My hour has not yet come." His mother ignores his words and says to the servant standing nearby, "Just do whatever he says." Our attention is then drawn to 6 stone water jars. They are used to wash cups and containers that might be in need of purification according to the Torah. People use them to wash their hands. Jesus nods his head to these jars and instructs the servants to make sure the jars are full to the brim. Go to the well if needed, get more water, and then pour some into a cup and present it to the master of the banquet. This is an act of generosity. Jesus doesn't have to do this. As he says, what has this got to do with him? And yet he gets involved. And once involved, he displays extravagant generosity. Those jars are to be full. We are told they carry between 75 to 115 liters of liquid each. There's a lot of speculation on the significance of the stone jars and their connection to the law. But I think one of the things we are meant to notice is that they are big. Jesus isn't just going to fix a problem, but this will be a show of abundance, a burst of grace. And yet it's also hidden. Only the servants and his disciples will know what has happened. It's worth pausing again and recognizing that Jesus, and by extension God, is generous. It's not all up to us, stressed and overwhelmed, to solve every problem that needs solving. We can turn to Jesus and experience his grace. This is a perspective on the world that trusts that there is enough because there is a generous God. The servants do as Jesus instructs and gives the cup to the master. He takes a sip and tastes wine. Good wine. Wine to celebrate with. Wine to savor and enjoy. He's confused. He doesn't know where this wine has come from. He calls the bridegroom to him, assuming that this is his doing, and congratulates him. Verse 9. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best to now." This, John tells us, is a sign, the first sign of who Jesus is. The best is about to come. It's an obvious and not so obvious sign. It's not fireworks bursting in the sky. It's the taste of good wine at the end of a party. Jesus, at this local celebration, is signaling things are changing for the better. And it kind of makes sense that this happens at a wedding, because weddings are a moment when things change. It's that formal moment when two become one. The turn of the new year can also feel like a moment when we are open to changing. I can find it hard sometimes to believe in joy overflowing, to take in the good. I can be like Mary, just looking for and fixing problems or creating problems. When I was 12, I was at the same great aunt's house who said the other day she wanted a wedding. She and her husband built this quirky house, 3 levels of circular stairs winding round and round, and a giant chandelier hanging above them. I was there because the wedding was about to take place. My second cousin was getting married. Now, this was only the second time I'd been to a wedding, so I was really keen to be part of it. But I think I was also a little anxious because I ended up standing on the top floor eavesdropping. I could hear the soon-to-be married couple arguing on the next floor, and I started to imagine worst-case scenarios. The wedding would be called off, and there'd be no fun or celebrations to be had. The next thing I remember, and my memory is hazy at this point, is that the chandelier began to swing. Did I touch it? I don't know. I do remember stretching out my hands to try and catch it as it began to fall, and the next thing I remember, I'm sitting on the stairs and there's glass all around me and frantic adults running to see what has happened. Thankfully, everyone was so distracted, the couple came out, stopped arguing, everything was fine, and the wedding went ahead. I can focus on the problems. I can see goodness as something that is breakable, but I've been convicted of the importance of nurturing joy. And maybe joy comes when we allow things to be shaken up. After the wedding, Jesus will cause a stir when he visits the temple, a very visible place. He drives out all the sheep and cattle he sees milling around. It's chaos, tables turning over, money scattering everywhere, people in an uproar. By what authority do you do these things? Give us a sign, the religious leaders will demand. Jesus is not anxious by their demands, but he replies, "Destroy this temple, and I'll raise it again in 3 days." Nobody gets what he's saying, and why would they? It doesn't make sense. The temple has taken years and years to rebuild. Why would they want it smashed? And how could he put it back together again so quickly? But Jesus is still sending the same message, signaling things are changing. In time, his disciples will realize that he was talking about his death. On the third day, after his death will come resurrection, the biggest celebration of them all. Cole Arthur Riley, writing about the value of nurturing joy, says, "Joy, which once felt as frivolous as love to me, has become a central virtue in my spirituality. I'm convinced that if we are to survive the weight of justice and liberation, we must become people capable of delight. And people who have been delighted in." What does this year hold for us? At the beginning of the year, the church traditionally celebrates Epiphany, that sudden realization that the glory of God is here. One of the things the medieval church would do at the beginning of the year is to take a piece of chalk and write a blessing on their doors. It was a prayer to God, "Be here, change us." And a reminder that God is here already in our homes and on our streets. Whatever might happen to us, we don't face it alone. And even the hard stuff is not the final word. This is why water is changing to wine. It's a taste of what is to come. This is what we are moving towards, gasps of surprise and laughter. We worship and trust in the God who celebrates, who's generous and surprising, bursting with joy. To help remind you, I want to invite you to come and take some chalk and go try this. Write on your door or on your street, send me a photo so I can share, a blessing. Be reminded that God's glory bursts in unlikely places, and commit yourself in 2024 to learning to live in the way of Jesus, a way that is good and full of joy.